Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today is one of my great heroes, Aaron Lansky, president and founder of the Yiddish Book Center, which is based in Amherst, Massachusetts. While a graduate student of Yiddish literature in 1980, Lansky founded the Yiddish Book Center, a nonprofit that works to rescue, translate, and disseminate Yiddish books. A graduate of Hampshire College, Aaron Lansky received a MacArthur Award in 1989. He is the author of Outwitting History about the founding of the Yiddish Book Center. And if you haven't read that book, I urge you to run and get it and to show you something about the art of the possible or the impossible, which became possible. Aaron Lansky, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Alan.
It's always great to see you. I meant what I said. It's a terrific story. So let's just, for those who've never heard the story, give a little bit of a précis of what happened in Outwitting History.
Should I tell you the absolute inception of the whole thing?
Yes.
All right, so I was a graduate student in Montreal at McGill. And I can remember really literally the day I'm sitting in class one day and the it's always cold and sleeting and snowing.
What year?
This would have been 78, I think, 1978.
Yeah.
So I'm sitting in class, the radiator's hissing, the sleet's pounding against the thing, the professor's droning on. And somewhere along the way, he says, I want you to read such and such a book for next week's class. And as always happened, the books were impossible to find. So as you remember from when we talked last time, Yiddish is a vast literature, but it's inherently modern. Jews spoke Yiddish for, what, like 1,000 years or so. But it wasn't until well into the 19th century that they began writing in it in earnest as a way of figuring out how do we live as Jews in a modern world. So it's great, it's passionate, it's lively, it's relevant, it's very contemporary. But the books were nowhere to be found. So at that very moment, I realized that, I could sit here and, you know, go on with the minutiae of literary studies for the next 20 or 30 years, or maybe I could take a little time off and go save the world's Yiddish books before it was too late.
Yes, but what made you say Yiddish books as opposed to others? You were sitting there, you had this moment, this aha moment, but what was it that made Yiddish so important to
Why
you?
Why Yiddish? All right, so that, for that we got to back up a little bit. So I grew up in New Bedford, Massachusetts.
Yes.
And I grew up probably like, you know, most people of my, most Jews of my generation, which is to say, you know, my parents spoke to us entirely in English, my grandparents spoke among themselves entirely in Yiddish, and, you know, Yiddish was the language that they spoke, they say, as the Einiklich Zoll nicht verstehen, when the grandkids weren't supposed to understand what they were talking about.
Right. So, same thing in my house.
Right. So this is no news to anybody, yeah, right? Yeah. This part of the story. But somewhere along the way, I went off to college, and my very first semester at Hampshire College, I took a course on the Holocaust. And by the end of the first semester, wasn't so much interested in, you know, how the Nazis did it, but way more interested in, so who were these Jews, and what was it about them that was so kind of, you know, antithetical to fascist ideology that the Germans literally pursued the destruction of the Jews above their war aims? And so I started studying Jewish history. I was really lucky in that I met up with an anthropologist named Leonard Glick. And because he was an anthropologist and because he was getting interested in the same subjects, he naturally asked what today we'd call social historical questions. Who were the Jews? Where did they live? What languages were they speaking? What were relations with the non-Jewish population? How were they making a living? And once you do that, you can't help but turn to Yiddish sources, because Yiddish, after all, was the language that something like 80% of the world's Jews spoke for the past 1,000 years. We sort of forget that now. You know, Hebrew was always there, but Hebrew was like Latin. That was the, they called it Lushan Koidish, the holy language, the language of scholarship and of prayer. But Yiddish was what they actually spoke. And I figured, how in the world am I going to understand this world without that language? So I started studying Hebrew, started studying German, and quickly realized I needed Yiddish.
Now, Yiddish is sort of a combination of German and Hebrew.
Well, that's a little too...
too easy.
Yeah, yeah, a little more complicated than that. But it sounds a lot like both German and Hebrew in some ways. So, like,
and it looks a little like it.
So here's the quick quiz here. You ready? So how many Jewish languages are there? Any idea?
How many Jewish languages are there? No, but they just found this little piece of paper
So that was Coptic, though, yeah. I like that.
Right.
18 Jewish, specifically Jewish yeah. languages. So that's a lot, you know. And so people know about Hebrew and Aramaic and Ladino, but there are all sorts of other ones, Judeo-Tat, Judeo-Persian, Judeo-Provençal. All these languages were sort of the same dynamic. It was, you know, Jews were sufficiently cut off from the populations among whom they lived that they kept their own languages intact. They all have a Hebrew core to them, but they're essentially a Jewish version of the indigenous language. And in doing that, there's a kind of countercultural quality to it, right? You know, there's something that's so powerful in all of that that it's very, very compelling. So I went off to college. I start studying Yiddish, and suddenly a whole world opens up to me. You know, what I didn't fully understand at that time was that beginning in the 19th century, you know, Yiddish had given rise to this literature that was just so, you know, alive and basically unknown. Even today, 98% of all Yiddish books have yet to be translated into English. We'll talk about that in a minute because we're working on that now. But 98% are untranslated, so it's like an unknown universe.
No.
So how could you resist? You know, Hebrew books were not in danger in the same way. But Yiddish books, you know, because of the way the language is sort of ripped out of the fabric of Jewish life, suddenly the books were the casualty of that. But it was just that great moment in history where, you know, that was sheer luck. That if I had tried to do this 10 or 20 years before to go out and save the world's Yiddish books, people would have thought I was nuts. Who cares? They're everywhere. Why worry about them? And 20 years later, they all would have been gone. So it was very fortuitous timing.
Well, you know, I love talking to you, Aaron Lansky, because, you know, you're just such an interesting man, and you always raise questions in my mind, and they're all off topic. But you said something a few seconds ago. I wanted to ask you about it, the Nazis and their pursuit of the Jews. Now, we know that this is, you know, classic scapegoating, but I often wonder. I thought Hitler made two major mistakes.
Just two, huh?
Well, two really major killers of his ideas. One of them was to invade the Soviet Union, and the other one was his pursuit of the Jews. Because I often wonder, had he not done that, would the Jewish population have basically, or some of them, supported him, number one? And number two, would he have succeeded in what he wanted to do?
Oh, that's a little off my expertise there, so I'm going to be careful on this one. But all I would say, I mean, it's really hard to ask those kind of questions. The only thing I will say is it was so maniacal, you know, what the Nazis were doing, that the idea of putting a rational yardstick against it doesn't quite work. You know, it was really, you know, Jews were, what, 0.7% of the German population at that point. So the very idea of singling them out in that way and blaming all the problems of the world upon them was so crazy. And then, of course, you know, led to such extremes that it's almost unspeakable at this point.
It's unspeakable.
Yeah.
Okay. So one other thing I want to point out to everybody is that the Yiddish Book Center, which you founded and which you've done such magnificent work with, also publishes a magazine. I love the magazine. You want to tell us a little bit about it?
Oh, that's very kind of you. And the magazine is called Packenträger, which is an old Yiddish word for the book peddler. So in traditional Eastern Europe, you know, Jews were living in these shtetlach, these small towns in the midst of an agrarian society. And the Packenträger was one of the few people who was kind of wandering back and forth from town to town selling books. And by the mid to late 19th century, suddenly that pack of books began to expand, not just to, you know, prayer books and religious books, but also he started carrying contemporary Yiddish fiction, which was modern and secular and mind-blowing and began to change the world. So it seemed like a perfect precedent for us. Magazine is edited by Lisa Newman. It's published in English entirely, or almost entirely. We do run some bilingual texts occasionally of Yiddish translations.
On one side of the page you see Yiddish and the other side.
Yeah, and recently redesigned by Alex Isley, a great designer down in Connecticut. And it's lively and fun, and people can find us at our website.
And I love it. And what's the website?
Yiddish Book Center, all one word, yiddishbookcenter.org.
Okay, this is just great. So, for those people who don't know the story, how you went out and you collected all the Yiddish books from people who were either on their way out or who were moving or whatever else, and one load after another and bringing it in and into this. And for anybody who hasn't been at the Yiddish Book Center, it is just a magnificent architectural feat. Tell us about what it looks like.
Well, if you drive up, we're on the campus of Hampshire College in Amherst. If you drive onto the campus, I promise you'll know when you get to us. Because suddenly, in the midst of this sort of 1970s red brick campus, you see a building that looks a little bit like a shtetl, or a little bit like a Jewish town of Eastern Europe. It was designed by this wonderful architect who's become one of my closest friends, named Alan Moore. Alan came from a very Yankee family. His family had owned the Stanley Tool Company in New Britain. But when we approached him about this commission, after interviewing 20 other architects who didn't get it, we approached Alan. He just understood it immediately. He went off to the Harvard Library. He researched Jewish architecture, and in particular the old wooden synagogues, this kind of vernacular architecture of Eastern Europe. And he built for us this magnificent building in which he and his wife worked personally on it, and he spent 4 years largely pro bono. And then, Alan, we doubled the size of it 2 years ago, because now we're awash in young people, and it's all educational programs, and we needed more space, so we doubled the size of the building, and the place is really hopping now.
I always try to ask everyone's question. So here's everyone's question. If so few people know Yiddish, if fewer people are knowing Yiddish, do you intend to bring Yiddish back, or...
I love the phrasing. Well, let's start out by talking about who does speak Yiddish.
Okay.
So now, you know, in 1939, there were 11 million Yiddish-speaking Jews in the world. By 1945, half of them had been murdered. In the Soviet Union, there was increasing persecution. Stalin murdered most of the country's major Yiddish writers on a single night in 1952. Israel was predicated on this idea of negation of the diaspora, you know, that this was sort of an aberration, and therefore turned to Hebrew. Not only turned to Hebrew, by the way, they were all Yiddish speakers who founded the state, but actually changed the Hebrew itself so it wouldn't sound like Yiddish. They were very keen to kind of put the past behind them. And in America, we had a whole completely different deal, which was Jews got here carrying this big, multifaceted civilization with them. And the deal in America was the Constitution protected religious freedom. But 100 years ago, there wasn't much truck for cultural differences. You know, multiculturalism definitely wasn't a word then. And so Jews did this funny thing. We sort of took this big, complex civilization, and we reinvented it in mainstream terms, meaning that we reinvented it as a religion divorced from culture. We kept the religion, and if we didn't throw away the cultural side completely, we definitely eclipsed it and swept it under the rug a little bit. And of course, Yiddish was lost too. Now, you could say, yeah, but that happened to every ethnic group that came here. True enough, or at least every ethnic group that came back then, except if you were Italian, you still had an Italy that was going to carry on the language, or a France, or a Poland, or, you know, where the language would carry on. For Jews, particularly after the war, that world had been destroyed. It was wiped off the face of the earth, and we were it. You know, this whatever continuity there was going to be here.
Ah.
So nowadays...
Did people bring books with them from the old country?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Of course, many of the Jews who came here were religious Jews who wouldn't have been reading Yiddish literature for the most part. But when they got to America, I remember my grandmother was 16 when... I don't remember this, but she was 16 when she came here. I remember that she would tell me stories. And she said she was working in a factory in New York. She had left her parents behind in Galicia, in Austro-Hungary, never saw them again. Came to America and said she had to work on Shabbos, on the Jewish Sabbath, and she was sewing some sort of muffs. And she said the muffs would be wet on Saturday because she would be crying so much that she had to work on the Sabbath. But she, like everybody else, you know, Americanized to some degree. And she started reading the Yiddish papers and started reading Yiddish literature as a way of getting her bearings in this new world, and did so, you know, till the end of her life. And I think that was typical of a great many. But, you know, whatever continuity there was going to be here. Nowadays, the Hasidim, who still live sequestered by choice, continue to use Yiddish as their spoken language. Although even that, Alan, I got to tell you, is not quite as absolute as you might think. We brought a group of our students down to Borough Park, you know, the Hasidic neighborhood in New York last summer. And we're going around, and the stores that sell to the broader public have signs in English. And the stores for the Jewish clientele are mostly in Yiddish and a little bit of Hebrew as well. And we pass by this place, and it's got a barber shop, and there's a big barber pole outside. In big English letters, it says barber. And then there are two words underneath it in Yiddish. And the first word says payas, which are the side curls that Hasidic men wear. And the next word is four Hebrew letters, fe, ayin, resh, mem, appears to say farm. And this professor who was with me from Ottawa said, Aaron, what do you think that means, payas farm? And actually, in Hebrew, F and P are sort of interchangeable. I said, you know, I don't think it says Pharm. I think it says Payas Perm. And this is where you go to get your payuses permed. So even there, we're making inroads, right? The modern world cannot be held entirely at bay.
Are the Hasidim teaching their children Yiddish?
I don't think they teach it. I think they just speak it. I mean, it is their vernacular. On the other hand, they're really down on Yiddish books because, as I just told you, Yiddish is the language in which Jews encounter the modern world, and that is not very high up on the Hasidic hit parade. So as a result, you know, they've always kept this at arm's length. But now, as we're going to talk in a minute, we've digitized the literature. We're putting a lot of books online. And we believe that a large number of the people reading Yiddish literature online now are Hasidim, who are doing it surreptitiously, and they can't discuss it with their neighbors. But this is the forbidden literature that they're reading, and they're starting to read Yiddish literature, which is, of course, written in their own language.
Wow. When you were a young man, a younger man, you're still a young man, but when you were a younger man and we had our original interview here at WAMC, you were, you know, on your way up. Now you're quite famous. I mean, my goodness, you've earned a MacArthur Award. They don't give those out easily. And, you know, you are now world famous. So my question is, do you travel the world? Do you go to Israel? Do you go to other places where this stuff becomes very important?
My daughter, when she was little, had a stuffed duck that she called Kachi Duck. Kachi is Yiddish for duck. Kachka is Yiddish for duck. So Kachi Duck. And at that point, she had this funny idea that whenever somebody was in a photograph, that they were famous. So one day she saw a picture of her stuffed duck and she looked and says, Kachi Duck famous, which has given rise to the expression in our house. Yeah, famous as Kachi Duck. So I think this is a relative term, although I'm flattered by your characterization.
No, I meant what I said. I wasn't trying to butter you up. I mean, basically, I wasn't trying to catch you up. But basically, this message supersedes the United States. I mean, have you been to Israel at the point? And when you go, how do they, based on what you said earlier about Hebrew being the official language, do you have to argue your way through the country?
Well, it's really funny. I was in Israel in, 1991. Yeah. I was invited there by UNESCO. The United Nations had just declared Yiddish an endangered language, and they had set aside money to figure out what to do about this problem. So I was one of two American representatives to this very high-powered, you know, conclave in Israel. The conclave is a different story. That we call that a nechta ketug. I get to the meeting. They go on for 3 or 4 days. And finally, I raised my hand. I said, excuse me, how much of a budget are we actually talking about here? And very sheepishly, the man from the Israeli government said, well, I'm very sorry to have to tell you this, but we spent the entire budget bringing all of you to Israel. So that was the end of that. But in the meantime, when I'm in a taxi cab, and I'm going to the, I think it was at Hebrew University where they were holding the meetings. And the driver asked me where I'm going. And my Hebrew is sort of rudimentary. And I explained where I was going. And he asked me what I was doing there. And I said I was going to a conference. And he said, what kind of a conference? And I said, oh, a conference about Yiddish. And the guy slams on the brakes. And I go flying forward. And he starts screaming at me how I'm betraying Israel by doing such a thing, by dredging up this forgotten past. That was 91. Times have changed a lot. Now, Yiddish is actually taught at all the major Israeli universities and many of the high schools. So, you know, everything, I think comes round over time. These kind of artificial ideologies where you try to, you know, we're going to erase the past and hide 2,000 years of this, that just doesn't make common sense, and I think it's only a matter of time. I also just have to say one other thing, which was that, you know, when Zionism was first kind of put forth as an idea in the 1890s. You know, this was, although it started with Herzl, who was a German speaker and saw German as the language of, the new Jewish state. It quickly found its traction in Eastern Europe among Yiddish-speaking Jews. But nobody could have imagined at that point that all the Jews of Europe would be, you know, particularly Eastern Europe, so many would be murdered, and that the demographic balance would shift, and that, you know, 700,000 or 800,000 Jews would be expelled from the Arab countries with no place to go and would end up in Israel. Who had nothing to do with Yiddish. Those were, you know, Sephardics and other Jews. And so as a result, you know, Yiddish just would have been chauvinism. Hebrew actually was brilliant. It might have started as negation, but it turned out to be brilliant because it was a lingua franca for Jews from countries, you know, speaking scores of different languages.
I'm sorry, I just missed something you said. You said it might have been seen as a negation. I don't get it.
Hebrew?
Yes.
That they turned to Hebrew originally as a way of kind of pushing the diaspora out of their consciousness, and we're going to return to something that predated the diaspora, to this kind of classical language.
Right.
But there was a prescience to the whole thing because it really did become a lingua franca in Israel. So to go back to your question, the Kachi Duck question, so yes, I travel everywhere, and I would say that interest in what we're doing is growing in ways that none of us could have imagined. In fact, I think like the best thing we ever did at the Book Center in recent years is we started a fellows program. So every year we take five preposterously brilliant young people from all over the world, and they come and spend a whole year with us, and they actually run the programs. I mean, you know, the kind of maxim now is that if you want to hire Yiddish speaking staff, you have to hire people under 30, because those are the ones who are going off to college and mastering the language and becoming quite, and they're more polyglot anyways, you know, and becoming proficient in it. So among the students, 2 years ago, we had a young woman from rural Norway. This year, we have a student who just arrived, a student she's in her mid-20s from Poland, who's not Jewish, learned Yiddish, saw it as a way to understand the culture that, you know, Warsaw was one-third Jewish before the war. It's completely erased today and wants to try to understand that past.
And
in a very
has an unfortunate reputation for anti-Semitism.
It's a long history there, yes. But today, you know, my kids say, that was so 5 minutes ago. I don't mean to suggest that there's no anti-Semitism in Poland anymore. But the world does change, and there's a more of an awareness of these things. The Yiddish festival in Krakow now every year that's loaded with, you know, both Jews and non-Jews alike flock to all of this. You know, the world does change in many ways.
So you think the character of countries change, like Germany doesn't have a national character, which led to a Holocaust, which could happen again?
Oh, Alan, you are really pushing me on these questions here. This is great. I love the political angle on all of this. That's really complicated. But do I think there were cultural roots?
Could I have a no or a yes?
Do I think there were cultural roots to the Holocaust? Yes. You know, was there a propensity towards an authoritarian culture that found a, you know, expression in Nazism? Yes. But are all human beings in all cultures capable of acting very, very badly? Also, yes. I mean, mm-hmm. We don't have to look very far to see examples of that. I remember I saw Elie Wiesel in New York, who speaks a beautiful Yiddish, by the way. And we were talking, and I said, my daughter at that point was very involved with this genocide in Darfur, trying to organize against this. And I was talking to him, and I said, why does this keep happening? And he looks at me and says, sadly, it is human nature. So I retorted that, well, yeah, but the opposite's also human nature, right? Human beings are capable of acting incredibly nobly, and they're also capable of acting incredibly basely. And these, I think, are both human potentialities, and the trick is to structure society in a way that forestalls the...
Yeah. But Aaron Lansky, that wasn't the question.
What was the question again?
The question
is there a national character?
Is there such a thing as national character that leads to some societies more to this than others?
I'd say... there are cultural roots, but if there's a national character that's fate and destiny forever, no, I don't believe that. Yeah. I think things change.
Yeah. Okay. I know that you want to get one piece of business done, and I want to get there, and that is the digitalizing of the Yiddish books that you collected. Now, everybody out there, you got to remember who this guy we're talking to is. This is Aaron Lansky. He rents a truck. He gets other people when he's a kid. They go around in the rain, in the snow, and they collect everybody's books, and they bring them back to the Yiddish Book Center, but there they sit. So now, Aaron figures, there's got to be a way that we can make this accessible to everybody. You want to tell us about that?
Yeah. So, you know, wanting to make it accessible to everybody goes back right to the first day we started doing this to try to get the books out there. But back in those days, all we could do was set up collections at libraries, you know, take duplicate books and catalog them, put them into libraries. And we ended up setting up collections in about 700 libraries in 26 different countries around the world.
Hmm.
Although we still have vast warehouses, you know, full of books as well. But then somewhere along the way, one of these brilliant young people that works with me came to me and said, why don't we digitize these books? I think it's possible to start doing that. It wasn't easy to figure out how to do it. We called up Xerox. It took them, who were kind of the industry leader at the time. This is 20 years ago now.
At the time.
Yeah. Well, you'll see the... Anyways, it took them 2 months to figure out they actually had a division that did this. They came around, but eventually they came, and after many, many very cordial meetings, it turned out they wanted $17 million to do the job. So that was far-fallen, and we had to move on from there. We ended up working with a company called Danka that was a spinoff of Kodak. They set up a factory in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. They worked three shifts a day for 4 years scanning the pages. Back then, it was really hard. This was so cutting edge that, you know, now you just take basically a photograph of each page of the book. Back then, you had to do, we said it was the General Westmoreland approach. You had to destroy the book in order to save it. You had to cut off its spine, feed the pages through one page at a time, and they were brittle and they would clog up the lenses. But somehow or another, we managed to scan maybe, I don't know, 11, 12,000 books that way. And at that point, all we could do was offer reprints on demand. Mm. And then another young person comes to me and said, this is 4 years ago, 5 years ago now, and said, you know, I think it's now technically possible. The internet's fast enough we could put the books online. So we called Google, and we worked with them for maybe 2 years trying to figure out how to do this. And then I got this very high-powered delegation came to see me one day of librarians from some of the university libraries in Massachusetts and told me in a very polite but firm way that this wasn't the way to go, that, you know, Google might be a very nice company, but somehow the idea of one private corporation controlling all of human knowledge probably wasn't a great social good, and that there was another way. The other way was a group called the Internet Archive in San Francisco. Have you ever heard of this?
Do you know? No.
Oh, well, it's really, then let me tell everybody, because it's so cool. There's a guy in San Francisco named Brewster Kahle, who is a computer pioneer, made a fortune, and then put all his money into first kind of taking snapshots of the internet in time, which nobody had ever done before, and then with the idea of digitization on a massive scale as a nonprofit venture. And so we decided we would work with them. We put 11,000 titles online 3 years ago. It took a lot of doing because the whole thing had been programmed to go from left to right, and Yiddish goes from right to left, and we found an Oracle programmer who agreed to do this for us pro bono and worked for a year and did the whole thing, and everything went up online and went live 3 years ago. And in the 3 years since, we're now well over 300,000 downloads. So, Alan, this is wild, right? If it had been 30,000, I'd still be here bragging to you about it, right? This is 300,000 Yiddish books have been downloaded all over the world. So as I told you, some may be coming from the Hasidic world. Most, though, are coming from young people all over the world who are intrigued by the language, are trying to understand this culture, and are reading in a serious way.
Now, how many of all the Yiddish books you collected are now digitalized?
We're working all the time. We now have a full-time scanning station in Amherst. We're working on this, but at this point, maybe 13,000 titles have been scanned, and the whole universe of Yiddish literature is closer to 40,000 titles. And we've been trying to get, we don't have everything, so we've been trying to get other libraries to work with us on this. Boy, was it hard going. They'd say to me, but if we put our books online, nobody will come to the library.
Yeah.
But that's not true. So, I talked to Bernie Margolis, who was a pioneer of this at the Boston Public Library. He said that it was exactly the opposite. He said they had books that hadn't circulated in 300 years. They put them online, and suddenly they had waiting lists of people wanting to come in and use these books. So it actually heightens demand. Digitization of books has become a very big thing in the world. And there's now an attempt to create a true digital public library that will encompass everything. But Yiddish has this amazing advantage, Alan, in that it's mostly not copyrighted. We didn't really know that because most of the books have a copyright indicia inside of it, you know, the little C in circle. But when we actually went down to Library of Congress and researched them, they never bothered to register the books. I always thought it was because they didn't know how to do it. Back then you had us, you know, now it's automatic. Back then you had to send in two copies and fill out a lot of forms. And these were, you know, immigrant socialists and anarchists, and it probably wasn't their inclination. Although I said this recently to my professor, to Ruth Weiss at Harvard, and I said, you know, I figure they just never bothered to do it. She said, that wasn't the reason. And I said, what was the reason? She said, because back then, nobody in their wildest dreams could ever have imagined they'd ever make money off of Yiddish books. So whatever the case might have been, it's essentially a mostly uncopyrighted literature. And therefore, we have the possibility now of making Yiddish the first fully digitized literature on earth. In fact, we're neck and neck with Balinese, but Balinese is a much smaller literature, so this is a big deal.
Now, you're the man who saved Yiddish books, but is there somebody who saved Balinese books? Forget it.
Quick, get the phone number. Call him up. It'd be a great interview. I don't know. There must be someone out there. So we've been looking for a partner to kind of fill what librarians call it lacunae, you know, the holes in the collection.
Now, you have to raise money, don't you? I mean, part of your job is the head macher in this whole thing. Is to raise the money for every time you get a good idea. The theory may be that there's somebody out there who would help pay for it. Now, there are things that are close to our hearts. you know, I'm sure some of the money that you have raised over the years, and there's a little, quite a bit, has been from somebody whose dear mother spoke nothing but Yiddish and who, therefore, this is incredibly important to.
We have 20,000 donors. It's a pretty retail operation. I'm sure you're familiar with this.
Sure.
You know, it's a lot of small checks that come in, but there have been major donors along the way. And in fact, the first really big gift for digitization was from Steven Spielberg, who created what's now known as the Shmuel Spielberg Digital Yiddish Library. So he's been very generous with that and very prescient. And now he's supporting translation for exactly the same reason. So you want to hear it. So books are digitized, but I don't want to mix metaphors here, but the holy grail in this whole thing is still to make the books searchable. You know, when you digitize a book, all it really is a picture of the page. But to make text out of that so you can then type in a word and search the literature, that requires something called optical character recognition, which is easy in English and almost impossible in Yiddish. And it was going to cost millions of dollars to do it. And we were waiting for the Israelis to invent it. And after years of work, they're up to 80% accuracy, which sounds pretty good till you realize that's a mistake every fifth letter, meaning a mistake every word. So that's useless. So last January, one of our young people, a young guy just graduated from Yale, comes upstairs to me and he said, Aaron, I just got an email. I think you got to take a look at this. And it's from some guy in France who says he's a computer programmer and he just invented Yiddish OCR, optical character recognition. I said, I don't believe it. I said, check it out for me. He checks it out. A week later, he comes back and says, you really got to look at this. Turns out there's a young 40-year-old computer programmer named Asaf Orielli. In fact, when I first spoke, he lives in France, and when I first spoke with him, we set up a Skype call, and my French is terrible, and I'm thinking, how am I going to communicate with him? Anyways, it turns out, not only does he speak more languages than I knew existed, but he was born in South Africa, raised in Israel, lived in Ireland, and then in Ohio, and now he's in the Pyrenees. And I said, what do you do for a living? How do you make a living? He said, well, he has a consulting firm in computer software, and he's the main programmer for the French Space Agency.
Wow.
So he's a rocket scientist. And he has given himself over to this project of developing this technology, and he has succeeded. It's more complicated than you can imagine. It's all arithmetical. It's spreadsheets with millions of data points in order to get every possible permutation, huge linguistic and morphological stuff, and he pulled it off. It's going live. What that means is that once this goes live,
yes,
you will be able to go on any computer in the world. You'll be able to type in any Yiddish word.
Give us an example.
My father's family came from Bialystok, so I could type in Bialystok, and in a matter of seconds,
in Yiddish,
yes. Unicode, your computer will do it too. Every computer will type it now. And within a matter of seconds, it will scan 5 million pages of Yiddish literature, and every time that word appears, it will tell you, and therefore research that might have taken 10 years will be done in 10 seconds instead. Not that. Sometime in the indeterminate future, we'll be doing this.
Soon. So this is extraordinary. Now, can you write the word in English?
Not yet. No, that's called romanization, and that's going to be a little ways away yet. But
so you would have to know a little Yiddish in order to do this.
Yes, right? But on the other hand, if you're looking for a Yiddish word in a Yiddish text, you better know Yiddish. So it's all going to work out just fine.
Aaron, you know, many of us have used Yiddish-isms or Yiddish in our writing. I mean, every American knows what the word chutzpah means. Or,
sure.
But there are never correct, you say, romanization. So you look up and say, okay, how do you spell chutzpah? You know? And you get four different answers or five different answers.
Or Hanukkah. Right. You get 82 different answers.
That's a great one. So how do you do that?
There's actually a system developed by an institute in New York called the YIVO Institute, and then Library of Congress perfected it, and we sort of carefully subscribe to it. Trouble is it doesn't make sense to people who aren't English speaking, because it's, you know, we have, you know, Roman letters can have different sounds in different alphabets. Right. So we actually just switched our whole online cataloging entirely to Yiddish, which is way easier for people all over the world. But yes, there is a way of doing this. And sometimes nobody knows what it means. Like our younger daughter's name is Chava. If we had spelled that with the proper romanization, it would have been K-H-A-V-E. And instead, we spell it C-H-A-V-A. And since people have enough hard time as it is with the Chava, C-H-A-V-A, I'm glad we didn't opt for the correct spelling on that.
I always would love to ask you personal questions, Aaron Lansky. Has your love of Yiddish, your saving Yiddish, becoming world famous, no matter what you say about it. Has that affected your children? I mean, you know, musicians have musical kids. How is that working?
Have you ever done anything in your life that didn't affect your children? Of course. You know, our kids grew up, immersed in all of this, and therefore have what I would say is a much broader understanding of Jewish culture than many of their peers. Meaning many kids, you know, they went to day schools and they have very good Jewish education, but it's largely a religious education. I think our kids have an instinctive understanding that there's a culture as well, that it goes much far beyond that. So my older daughter is a student at McAllister in St. Paul, where she's studying anthropology and international studies. At the moment, she's in Cameroon. We won't even talk about that, how she, you know, We're doing okay on the home front, but she's having a great time. But the truth is, you know, she, like so many of her generation, has grown up in a wildly multicultural world. McAllister has kids from 82 different countries. You know, that's a very different world than certainly I knew growing up. And as a result, when she thinks of culture, and I think her peers as well think about culture, you know, they think about it broadly. So when they think about their own identity, you know, they naturally are asking, like I did all those years ago, they're naturally asking cultural questions. So my daughter actually enrolled in our Yiddish program 2 years ago without telling me she had applied. She got in, she took a summer-long program in Yiddish, and now she Skypes me from Cameroon and speaks to me in Yiddish, so the other people there won't know what she's talking about.
Oh, boy, just like your grandparents. So, you know, I keep meeting people, and they tell me, I'm a cultural Jew.
Yeah,
now,
that's a
they
good question.
They don't mean I'm a Yiddish-speaking cultural Jew who has embraced this culture. They mean I don't do religion, but I feel fiercely about my being Jewish.
Yes, that's a fantastic question. And now we're actually in my, intellectual bailiwick as well here. So let me see how to answer this. You know, I think a lot of times when people say I'm a cultural Jew, yes, it implies a rejection of a kind of religious world. You know, they're modern people. But I don't know that it always bespeaks a commitment to cultural learning. Now, they don't have to go out and learn Yiddish if they don't want to. I mean, that's a lot of learning, although we would love it if they did. But it does presuppose that, okay, you're a cultural Jew, so who are your 100 favorite contemporary Jewish writers? Tell me about Jewish music. Let's talk about Jewish film. Let's talk about theater. You know, there's a whole constellation out there. And usually a cultural Jew means, I don't like religion, I like the culture, but I don't know very much about it. So I would say if they want to be a cultural Jew, great, more power to them. Send them over to Amherst and we can start, let's get started to, learn about that culture because it's vast and it's really important. You know, the other thing, Alan, is it's not just Yiddish. You know, Yiddish is the starting point. It was Jews' first encounter with modernity. It did produce this amazing literature. But, you know, the story didn't exactly end there. It goes on now in English and in modern Hebrew and in Spanish and in Russian and other languages. So, you know, we're really embracing a much wider scope of Jewish learning. In fact, we're starting a brand new program called Tent, which is for young people ages 20 to 30. We'll have programs all over the country where people can go and study for 1 week a particular aspect of contemporary Jewish culture. So it might be comedy or food or theater or creative writing, but to understand its sort of Jewish implications. So the answer is yes, I'm all for it if they're a cultural Jew, but it does take knowledge like everything else.
I have a friend named Elliot. And Elliot was a teacher in Yonkers for many, many years. I love the guy. One day, as sort of a special treat, we understood that you guys were going to show a film. And the film was on what we call the Commie Coops in the Bronx.
Right.
And I remember Elliot's house very well because it had in the cement above the door, it had a hammer and sickle. And you showed this film, and I was wet in the eyes watching it. And so was he, because, you know, this was beyond the study of Yiddish.
Right.
It was the culture of what happened in them days. I wonder, I know that the Norman Rockwell Museum often has things that are not about Rockwell or illustration. They reach out to other ideas. Shakespeare and Company does the same thing in Lenox, Massachusetts. So how much do you do at the center that is not specific to Yiddish, but related to Yiddish or to culture?
The answer is we do a vast amount of it and try to show its intellectual roots. So this summer, for the first time ever, we ran a week-long program for high school students. God, were these kids amazing. They came from all over the country. We were only able to take 18 of them. They were really, you know, kind of the best and the brightest. And we read Isaac Babel, and we read Grace Paley. You know, these are Russian, English, I mean, writers in many different languages, and put it all into a broader context, and it was amazingly affecting for the kids. Boy, they engaged with it in ways that I couldn't have imagined. They didn't always have the kind of political and historical nuance. You know, we had to kind of explain the context of the Russian Civil War for them to understand where that came from. But in terms of responding to the broader themes, they were able to do that in an extraordinary degree, and it was a life-changing program for those students. And the beauty of it is now they go on to academic programs in Jewish studies when they get into college, and, you know, there's loads of learning all over the world that they can immerse themselves in. So on all fronts, you know, we teach Yiddish too. We have a full-time Yiddish professor named Asya Weissman just joined our staff, and we're actually leapfrogging from the last great Yiddish textbook, which was done in 1947. And she's creating the next great Yiddish textbook, which will be iPad-based. So you can not only, you know, learn from it, but you can push a button and audio will pop up and you hear things and see things, and it's a multimedia experience. But we're also doing, you know, a very wide range of educational programs as well.
Who's going to star in the movie? Because, you know, there is a movie here. I love the idea of you're going to Spielberg or somebody going to Spielberg and saying, what a great movie. This guy, he's sitting there in Hampshire College all these years ago. He decides to save Yiddish on his own. He's a kid and he does it. And you take it through the generational years. You know, it's got to be done. Do you want to play you in the movie?
I'll let you and Stephen talk that over. How's that? Right now, we got so much work to do. That's really very, I promise you, that's not what I think about. People often say to me, they walk in and go, oh, you must be so proud of this. You look out on all these books. It never works that way. I look out on all those books and think, boy, have we got a lot of work to do.
Are your parents gone?
My dad died 2 years ago, and my mom is still alive.
And what did they think of all of this?
I think at first there was some consternation about making a living, and now I think we'd probably, the operative verb would be she quells. I think she's very pleased with the whole thing. In fact, my mom has Parkinson's. She's in a Jewish assisted living, but hadn't been out of her apartment in a year. And one day, just a few months ago, one of our docents comes in. He said, Aaron, someone's here to see you. And I said, really, who is it? He said, well, it's your mother. I said, well, I don't think that's possible. Anyway, she had gotten her aid, and they got on a van, and she came to see me. It was the most heroic thing she'd ever done. And if you want to, you know, they put those little pictures next to words in the American Heritage Dictionary. Sure. Next to Kfell, they should have had the picture of her that day. So, that was very nice.
Tell us about the MacArthur. When did you know you got it, and what has it meant to you?
Well, that goes back a little ways. That was 1989. I was in New York fundraising, as it happens, and I got a call from I called my office from the payphone. We didn't have cell phones then. Mm-hmm. And she said, outgoing president of Hampshire College, who was going to be the president of the MacArthur Foundation, said that she had a donor she wanted me to meet, and she wanted me to be at her house at 7 the next morning. So I took a train back from the city, and I remember I woke up that morning, and I was so rushed to get to her house that I remember ironing the two front panels of my shirt and put on a jacket because I didn't have time to iron the rest of it. And I think I'm about to meet with some big donor, and she sat me down in her living room, and I'm looking all around, and there's nobody else there. And it was she who told me that I had gotten the MacArthur, and I must admit, it was one of the few times in my life I think I stood with my mouth agape and really didn't know what to say. And it was absolutely life-changing, not because of the money, but because of the, the hechsher, you know, the kind of imprimatur that it put upon all of it. And the most immediate consequence was about 6 months later, I met my wife and we got married.
How did that happen?
A professor of mine set us up on a blind date, and we got engaged in 10 days, although with a trip to the Soviet Union in between there.
I'm speechless. So how has the money helped you from the MacArthur?
Oh, you know, back then it used to be age dependent. The younger you were, the less you got. I always thought it should have been the opposite. But nonetheless, it basically paid my salary for 5 years. But it was more than I had been making.
Is that over now?
Oh, long ago, yeah. That was a long time ago. Whenever we get a letter from them, my wife always says, oh, maybe they're going to give us another one, which would come in very handy. But no, that has not happened. And, but it was, no, it really was life-changing in terms of putting me in touch with different people and opening up doors and just kind of giving a sense that, you know, this is really important. This is a significant culture that needs to be dealt with in a serious way.
Has any fellow who has come in now, you know, when we first met, you know, fellow Schmello, there wasn't much. But now there's this fantastic operation. Has anybody ever really given you a hard time? you know, who's come in that you've chosen and say, oh, brother, what did we have to do this for?
Oh, God, no. Exactly the opposite. Yeah. Never, ever, ever. Uh-huh. You know, I just have to tell you, I'm sure you see this in your students also, that, sure. You know, the best of the current generation is better than anything I have ever seen before. You know, these kids are so smart and they are so aware of the world and they're deeply idealistic, but also have an element of practicality about them as well. And they all bring that to bear on what they're doing. So they immerse themselves in these projects. And, you know, and at a very young age, in their early 20s, they are running really major endeavors. One young woman started a podcast series, one started an oral history project, which is now running all over the country and capturing, you know, interviews with people before it's too late and chronicling a younger generation as well. Another one, this is an amazing story. You'll like this story, Alan, only because it's a radio-related story. So I went with my younger daughter to look at colleges in Montreal a few years ago. And while we're there, we walk into a place called the Jewish Public Library, where I had done most of my research when I was in grad school. And I walk in and I met the director and I introduced her to my daughter and we sat down in her office and she reminded me that many years ago we had taken, we'd found 10 recordings there of Yiddish books read aloud by Yiddish actors back when there were still Yiddish actors to be doing this. And we had remastered them and issued them as CDs and we started talking about it. And all of a sudden, it was like this, you know, who's the guy that with the Nixon tapes? Butterfield, was that his name? It was a moment like that. She said to me, well, would you be interested in the rest of the tapes? And I said, what rest of the tapes? Turns out they had another 200 books read aloud sitting in old cassettes and shoeboxes in the basement. So,
no.
So great. Of course, we'll take it, we'll digitize it, we'll put it up on the internet. Absolutely. I go back, and I sent out a letter to all of our members telling them about this to raise money to go save and digitize all this stuff because it's expensive. And I get an email back from a friend of mine who's now the head Judaica bibliographer at Stanford, but once had worked at this library in Montreal. And he said, you know, when I worked there, I remember those cassettes, he said, but there were also a lot of old reel-to-reel tapes in the cellar, and I think you ought to check it out.
Oh, my God.
So I send two of our fellows up there, and they come back. Turned out, you ready for this? There were 1,500 reel-to-reel tapes down in the basement.
Wow.
You know, so these were like 90 minutes each. And they dated back to the very early, I think late 40s, early 50s, and continued from there. So after the war, most of the great centers of Yiddish culture were destroyed. Montreal was one of the few exceptions, because when Jews got to Montreal, the French didn't want them and the English didn't want them, so they created their own cultural institutions. Yiddish was much more alive to a much later date. Even today, the Jewish schools are still quadrilingual with Hebrew, Yiddish, English, French. So when I was in grad school, I used to go to these lectures every Saturday night.
You were where at grad school?
McGill.
McGill.
Yeah, it'd be 20 below zero and 300 people would show up on a Saturday night to listen to a lecture on some obscure point of Yiddish literature entirely in Yiddish. And who knew all this stuff was being recorded on professional, you know, reel-to-reel equipment. So these tapes had just lain there all those years. So we started digitizing. We found a company in Boston that could do this. It's very complicated, and started posting everything up to iTunes. When they sent back the first, you know, with those little memory sticks, something, the first memory stick with the first four lectures on it, and I plug it in, and oh my God, there's Chaim Grada, you know, one of the great Yiddish writers, and he's speaking. I had goosebumps up and down my arms. Can you imagine? It's like listening to like Emily Dickinson or Melville giving a sure. talk or something. I mean, it's just wild. You know, the world you thought that was gone forever.
You know, my folks had a Yiddish actor friend named Michael Gorin, and he used to appear down on Second Avenue in the, you know, plays like The Pickle Dealer's Daughter. And a lot of them were in Yiddish, but some of them were Yiddish plays that had been translated to English in great Yiddish theater. Do we still have that? Or?
Yes, we do. In fact, there were a great many of them. And you want to know which one was the most popular of all was King Lear.
Interesting.
So why King Lear? They said it was the ultimate Jewish story. Tzoras mit Kinder, trouble with the children. The Jews could relate to that. But yeah, there was a vast repertoire that came from Western literature. In fact, we have thousands and thousands of titles of Western literature translated into Yiddish because these were Jews, you know, discovering the world, and they did it through their own language.
Yeah. So what's next?
Well, now we push forward on a number of fronts as well. First of all, digitization alone is still a very big project, but we've just finished making a partnership with the National Library of Israel. It's like their Library of Congress, to begin systematically to scan the rest of Yiddish literature. So that's what I was saying before. Yiddish really will be the first fully you know, digitized literature on Earth, all available online, all searchable. That's one very, very big project ahead of us. All these other things, you know, with the audio and the different treasures that keep, you know, appearing miraculously with extraordinary regularity, that's still going to happen as well. But the real focus now shifts to education. I mean, it's sort of common sense. You know, how can you have all of these treasures and not share them with the world? And the other part was that I was pretty young when I started doing this. Sometimes I'm...
How young?
Like 23. That's pretty young, right?
Yeah, oh, indeed.
Yeah, and...
especially at my age.
And, you know, at that age, I'm not sure how I knew to do all this, but I, you know, it was just what had to be done, and it was sort of one day at a time and one step at a time. It wasn't a eureka moment. It was just, you know, let's go pick up the next 12 houseloads of books.
I fully
today.
Understand this. This is precisely what happened. You get a lot of credit. I don't for WAMC, but that's exactly what happened. We took something that was basically dead, and we took one step and another,
that's
and everything
right,
led to everything else.
Right. And you don't start out with, here's where we're going to be 50 years from now. You start out with, here's where we're going to be tomorrow, hopefully. You know. Mm-hmm. And so that's really how it all began. But I wasn't doing it for very long before I understood in a profound way that the Yiddish books were just the tip of the iceberg. You know, Jews are a really bookish people. I don't know about you, when I was a kid growing up, if we dropped a book on the floor, if it was Norman Mailer or it was a volume of the Torah, it didn't make any difference. We picked it up, we kissed the book. It was like this kind of axiomatic, you know, this kind of just reflexive thing that we were supposed to do, because Jews had this innate respect for books, which was the embodiment of a culture for a people without a country of their own, at least at that moment. And so they were really important. So how did ago that one of the most bookish people on the planet literally threw away a literature, discarded, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of their most valuable books. And that was emblematic of a much bigger problem, as I say, that we really lost the totality of our culture. You know, the culture was dialectical. It was holy and it was every day. And it was the constant juxtaposition, the butting up of one against the other that gave us our humor and our social conscience and our passion and our, you know, our insistence on justice.
But Aaron, you said before that your parents didn't speak Yiddish, that your grandparents did, and when your parents with us, that's right.
But
yes, that's
six.
Right. Yeah. So now Spanish people are coming to the United States.
Yes.
In record numbers. Soon they'll be the majority of the country. But what I love about the Spanish culture now is I think they may have learned something, which is that they want their kids to speak Spanish as well as English. And that is not something that we saw among Yiddish-speaking people.
The country changed. You know, if Jews were coming here now, it would have been a very different story.
You think so?
Yeah. Yes, I do. I mean, I think it's imperative that everybody learn English. I think it's imperative there be a, you know, basic common polity in the country. But I also think it's imperative that we, you know, don't lose cultures. They're way too precious. So in that case, Yiddish is a stand-in for all of the cultures that have been sort of neglected and eclipsed. And I think the notion of cultural reclamation is a challenge for all of us.
Well, Aaron Lansky, you are, as I said in the beginning, my hero. I choke up when I listen to this story. You said you get goosebumps sometimes. I get goosebumps when I listen to you. Our guest has been Aaron Lansky, president and founder of the Yiddish Book Center, sometimes known as the man who saved the Yiddish language. Thank you so much, Aaron, for joining us. It's been too long, and we hope you'll come back a lot sooner the next time.
I'll be looking forward. Thanks, Alan.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.